So tonight's talk is based on the Kakka Kupama Sutta, which is the 21st sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It translates roughly as the simile of the saw. But actually, this sutta is a collection of stories and suttas that the Buddha uses to illustrate the meanings of right action and right speech. How we act in the world. And it's right action and right speech in relation to other people, what they say and what they do. And this is an area where we're often quite reactive. A lot of our reactive energy, if it's not to our own crazy mental stories that are silent, are how we interact with other people in the world. And so this is, I think, a lot of good advice is what this sutta has. And so I'll be reading little bits of the sutta and then coming back and talking to you about what I read. And so the first of these stories is about a bhikkhu named Paguna. And how he has sort of strayed from the straight and narrow of the practice for someone who has gone forth, a bhikkhu. Paguna, this is the Buddha speaking. Paguna, is it true that you are associating overmuch with the bhikkhunis? That you're associating so much with the bhikkhunis that if any bhikkhu speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you become angry and displeased and make a case of it. And if any bhikkhu speaks dispraise of you in those bhikkhunis' presence, they become angry and displeased and make a case of it. Are you associating so much with the bhikkhunis as it seems? Yes, venerable sir. Paguna, you are not a clansman. You have gone forth out of faith from home life into homelessness. Yes, venerable sir. Paguna, it's not proper for you, a clansman who has gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, to associate overmuch with bhikkhunis. Therefore, if anyone speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you should abandon any desire and any thoughts based on the household life. And herein you should train thus. My mind will be unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. That is how you should train, Bhikkhuna. And if anyone gives those bhikkhunis a blow with his hand, with a clod, with a stick, or with a knife in your presence, you should abandon any desire and any thought. So he's pointing out that Bhikkhuna is a monastic. Bhikkhuna is supposed to be not acting like a householder anymore. And he is. And so the Buddha is trying to make two points here. Number one, that the Bhikkhuna felt it was right for him to defend the nuns, the bhikkhunis. And the nuns felt dependent on him and felt they needed to defend him. Both of these are not proper for someone who has gone forth. When you first think of this, it's like when I first read this, it was like, well, of course, this is like what people do. They take care of each other, right? But within the tradition of having gone forth, having taken orders, having becoming a monastic, it's improper. And these they're both they're breaking their vows in a sense. And the second thing is the monk Paguna should understand that the nuns are perfectly capable of dealing with this situation, that they don't need his protection, and the nun should understand that part of their training is to stand on their own. In both cases, their mind should be unaffected by what's arising. whether someone's complaining about them or complaining about this monk who takes care of them sometimes, they should be unaffected. And same with Paguna, should be unaffected. His mind should stay calm. He should with and he shouldn't get involved. Their mutual duty, both Paguna and the bhikkhunis, is to practice. That's what they've taken on. They've taken on, this is my only duty. It's to practice. And expecting anger isn't wholesome. It's an identification with self, with a sense of a separate self. With the idea that they are someone, and so are these bhikkhunis are someone. And so they're getting caught in identification with the ideas of what would normally arise in the householder's mind. And all anger, because remember, in both cases, both the Faguna was getting angry and the bhikkhunis were getting angry. And that anger is arising out of the situation that they've created by associating with each other too much, right? And all anger, this is a, I came across this in one of the commentaries. All anger arises from thwarted lust or wounded pride. Now, lust in this case doesn't necessarily mean physical lust. It means lust in the sense of really wanting something really strongly. Paguna wants to be feel important, right? And so when he gets to feel important because he's taking care of the bhikkhunis. And when so when someone insults the bhikkhunis, he gets angry because his sense of importance is being threatened. Right? Or and so that's being threatened. Also, his pride is being now because he thinks I can take care of these bhikkhunis, and now all of a sudden something's happening where he can't. And so his pride is affected. So all of the, he's being caught in this emotional whirlpool, right? Joseph Goldstein has some interesting comments on something similar here. This is from his book, Insight Meditation. Our great challenge and potential is to learn how to stay open to the whole range of feelings, without adding this extra sense of I and mine in the midst of it. One practical device that often helps us is to see three things going on in the midst of a strong emotion. When we become angry, for example, first there is some external situation prompting the anger to arise. Someone is doing or saying something we do not like, or we feel is harmful to ourselves or others. Second, there is our reaction to that situation, namely the feeling of anger. And the third component is the relationship of our mind to the anger itself. Usually we are lost in the first two, the external situation and our reaction to it. Something happens, we get angry. As we get angry, we start thinking about what has happened. All those thoughts create more anger, which in turn creates more thoughts about the situation, often with blame, self-righteousness, and hurt feelings. Thus, we quickly become caught in a destructive loop. If you seek a way out of such cycles, try turning your attention away from the situation and your reaction to it and towards the third component, the relationship of your mind to the emotion, whether it is anger, fear, or whatever. For example, in the midst of a whirlwind of anger, you might ask yourself, how am I getting caught in this anger? How am I being hooked by it? How am I identifying with it? Asking some form of that question is completely different from considering the external situation. At such a time, we are no longer sending out threads of blame that bind us to the situation, to the reaction, and to our identification with the emotion. We are no longer thinking about the external causes of the anger, so we are no longer feeding it. We do not ask the question for the purpose of getting an answer. It's interesting, huh? We ask the question without expecting an answer. How often do we do that? Or having an intellectual response. Rather, the question's purpose is to help us change perspective, to take responsibility for what arises in our mind. In the moment of asking, "How am I getting hooked?" we have already moved outside the anger and are looking at the way we are relating to it. It is impossible in that moment for the whole mass of anger to dissolve without our denying it, repressing it, or shoving it away. It's like you're caught in a mind storm, whether it's about anger or about lust or who knows what it's about, grief or fear or whatever. And you realize you're caught, right? That's step number one. So I have to be mindful. You're mindful that, oh, I'm caught in this storm. And you just stop. And you just say silently to yourself, maybe not even in words, but it's like, what the heck's going on? Why am I so caught here? Whatever phrase you use, I've been using "what's going on" is my favorite phrase for this at this point. It's just because it's like it just stops the process of connecting to the story. Connect, there's a whole story going on here, and I'm just going, why am I telling myself this story? Why am I watching this mind movie? Why am I getting so caught up in it? And just that, just asking that question, and then just sitting still and seeing what arises. Often what arises is, oh, you see it for what it is. It's just a reactive, an old habitual reactive pattern. And then you can choose. I don't need to continue on in this reactive pattern. It may continue on anyway. I mean, but now you're mindful of it. Now it isn't just your mind running. It's you being mindful of the fact that your mind's running. It's very different. Very different mind state. It's to be actually mindful. Even in the midst of this mind storm, this crazy story, if you're mindful, oh, this is just a crazy story. Maybe even laugh at yourself a little bit about being caught in this mind storm. Sometimes laughing about it is pretty good too. It's just being able to step back that little bit and go, ah, oh, what's going on? That's often all we need to do. And this is both true when you're sitting in your formal practice and out there in the world, probably more valuable out there in the world, when you're getting caught in some storm up there, to just step back and sort of have a wider perspective. The Dalai Lama says sometimes when you're doing this, if you can and you see you're caught, try and look at this story you're telling yourself and see, well, what if I look at it from over here? We're up over here or down over there, and try and get all these, see if you have different perspectives on the same story. Because then often you can see really clearly that's all it is. This is just the story, and I'm caught reacting to it because I can look at it from all these different angles. And now it's not, I'm not like committed to one way. And I know the answer, and they're right, not I'm right, and they're wrong, which is often where we get caught, right? And we can just go, oh, okay, this is just what things, what's how it is now, and that's all there is. When I was involved. Prior to this tradition, I was practicing in a very different Hindu yoga tradition. We used to have little songs that our teacher had taught us that we would chant as part of the kirtan. A lot of the kirtan would be, in Sanskrit mantras, but then it would be these little English songs would sing, right? And the one that always sticks in my mind because it seems so relevant to me even today. Now we're talking 35 years later. It's like, it was went, bear insult, bear injury, highest yoga. Just bear insult, bear injury, highest yoga. Don't get caught. That's what it was about. Just be able to hear things and take those things in and not get wound up. Yeah. Another part of that was adapt, adjust, accommodate. Like we have to adjust and adapt and accommodate to what's happening now without getting caught in the whirlwind. And at the time, those were just like these funny little songs that Swamiji made us sing, right? But the more I think about them, over the period of my life, it's like, yeah. He was really getting at something. I mean, he made us sing this. We sang this all the time. It was just like every day I almost would sing this song. It was just a song, right? But it's like he was trying to teach us something in this simple way. And it just took a while for it to sink in, I guess. But anyhow. So what the Buddha's talking about here also is what we'll call righteous anger. That we think it's okay to express or even act out from a place of anger if we are right. And we see this all the time today in our culture, in our world, in our political world, in our business world, in all kinds of different worlds that we're part of. People are, because they know they're right, feel it's perfectly all right to rant against, attack, physically attack others, the other, whatever that is. That's the extreme of what I'm talking about. It's not just something that's going on in our head. Now we're putting it out there into the world, and that energy causes incredible harm, obviously. Anyhow, so that's the first story. And here's a And here's the Buddha actually explaining how to do this in a sense. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus: Bhikkhus, there was an occasion when the bhikkhus satisfied my mind. Here I address the bhikkhus thus: Bhikkhus, I eat at a single session. By so doing, I'm free from illness and affliction, and I enjoy lightness, strength, and comfortable abiding. Come, bhikkhus, eat a single session. So part of the tradition for the monastics was they'd only eat one time a day. And they had to eat before noon. And it was like the idea being they wouldn't put so much energy into getting food all the time and taking cooking food and making food. In fact, they weren't allowed to cook. They had to go out and do their dana round, and the villagers would give them food. But they only did it once a day. That kept them light, because they didn't eat and then they digest. When you eat a big meal and then you digest, have sort of like that sort of dozy feeling you get after eating a big meal. Well, if you only eat one meal a day, it's like all that rest of that time you have to practice, and it has a sort of a lightness to it, right? And I had no need to keep on instructing those bhikkhus. I'd only to arouse mindfulness in them. Suppose there were a chariot on even ground at the crossroads, harnessed to thoroughbreds, waiting with a goad lying ready, so that a skilled trainer, a charioteer of horses to be tamed, might mount it, and taking the reins in his left hand and the goad in his right hand, might drive out and back by any road wherever he likes. So too, I had no need to keep on instructing those bhikkhus. I only had to arouse mindfulness in them. So if we're the image he's using here, and this image of a chariot sort of parked, ready to go, this is like if our mind is still, because the chariot is still, but when we need to go out into the world in action, because we're starting from a calm, still place, we can do that. We can go out there and actually act. And then he goes on. This is the next story. Formerly, because in this Savati, there was a housewife named Vedika, and a good report about Mistress Vedika had spread thus. Mistress Vedika is gentle. Mistress Vedika is meek. Mistress Vedika is peaceful. Now, Mistress Vedika had a maid named Kali, who was clever, nimble, and neat in her work. The maid, Kali, thought, a good report about my lady has spread thus. She's just wonderful. Here it is now. While she does not show anger, it is nevertheless actually present in her, or is it absent? Or else it is just because my work is neat that my lady shows no anger, though it is actually present in her. Suppose I test my lady. So the maid Kali got up late. Then Mistress Vedika said, hey, Kali, what is it, madam? What is the matter with you, getting up so late? Nothing is the matter, madam. Nothing is the matter, you wicked ghoul. Yet you got up too late. And she was angry and displeased, and she scowled. Then the maid Kali thought, the fact is that while my lady does not show anger, it is actually present in her, not absent, and it's just because my work is neat, and that my lady shows no anger, though it is actually present in her, not absent. Suppose I test my lady a little more. It's really, Kali's a real troublemaker. Huh? So the maid Kali got up later in the day. Then Mistress Vedika said, hey Kali, what is it, madam? What's the matter with you? You got up later today. Nothing is the matter with me. And so the lady scolds her again. And then she does it a third time. Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl. Yet you get up later in the day. And she was angry and displeased. And she took a rolling pin and gave her a blow on the head. Yep. So what's the Buddha getting at here? What is this story? What is he trying to illustrate here? So as the Sutta goes on, the Kali goes around and tells everybody that her mistress, though she looks really calm, is really, really mean and actually hit her with a rolling pin and, you know, causing more trouble, right? So the Buddha's warning about two things here. First is that it's easy to be calm and peaceful if you aren't bothered or distressed. You know, if everything is going fine and your life is great and your maid is taking you getting up at the right time or whatever, you know, you're getting up at the right time. Things are, life is easy and good, right? Let's not forget about the maid part for us. But then it's easy to be calm and peaceful. But when things aren't going so well, the real test is when things go wrong, especially if it affects you. You know, people often appear holy or put on the appearance of being holy just to get what they want or to be praised. Suppressed emotions always come out in the end, often in very unpleasant ways. You know, you get hit with a rolling pin, right? And so here he's pointing to, don't pretend, don't put on the airs of I'm the holy person. Because just like we all, I mean, what he's describing here is what's called a latent tendency, right? We can appear calm and cool and collected, but it's there. These other unwholesome energies are there. All we have to do is be provoked. And can you be mindful enough when you're provoked, just like we were talking about in the earlier example, Can you be mindful enough so that you don't react? That you don't, start whacking your mate with your rolling pin, metaphorically speaking. Then the Buddha goes on. Bhikkhus, there are five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connect with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. When others address you, their speech may be timely or untimely. So here this is like this classic thing. This is like the meme you see on Facebook or something, right? About
The Buddha said.
but he's talking about all these ways where it's possible to not speak appropriately. And so what he's pointing to is first of all, speech has all these sort of, we'll call them traps, these pitfalls that we can fall into if we're not careful. And so when you speak, it's wise to pause a little bit and ask yourself, is what I'm about to say timely? Is it like, does it make sense to say this right now? You're with you have something you need to explain to someone. Maybe they haven't acted properly or whatever it is. You have to say something to someone, and there you are, and there they are, and you notice that they're really sort of wound up and excited or distressed or something, and maybe it's not, maybe I you have to go, oh, maybe this isn't the right time, even though you want to do it right now because it's sort of on your mind. Maybe it's not timely. Maybe it isn't appropriate at this time. Maybe I should wait till we can sit down quietly and do it then. Right? Timely. Is it true? Very simple. Is it true or untrue? Is what you're saying actually the truth, or is it just something that you sort of made up along the way? Gentle or harsh. Having a gentle speech is, if you can consciously choose not to growl and bark, which is harsh speech. This was a habit of mine that I had to really watch and still have to watch to some extent. Where I'm just like, if things weren't going my way, I would just, because I have this sort of big drill sergeant voice, if I want to sort of use it, I can bark really loudly. Right? And it was just, it never caused anything except more trouble and grief for me and for those around me. It was just really harmful. It just took me a while to realize that. But it's like harsh speech never, it sort of, the thing about harsh speech is it's sort of like, it feel has that righteous, that self-righteous energy that I was talking about a minute ago. Where it's like, I'm right and I can bark and say this and, just make sure they understand, right? My duty to make sure they understand. Connect with good or with harm. Is what you're saying leading towards something wholesome or is it leading towards something unwholesome? Is it going to cause hurt or is it going to cause goodwill? And is it, and then the last one was, is it speaking from a place of loving kindness? Or with inner hate, with ill will. And we have to go, and if we think, oh, what would it be like if everybody, before they said anything, made sure all five of those things were there in their speech. First of all, we wouldn't speak as much, probably. But it's like, it's a way of consciously, before you speak, making sure that you're not going to cause any harm to yourself or to others, which is part of, the first precept, non-harming, taking care of and not cause harm in the world. We speech is where we cause probably more harm than anything else. Joseph Goldstein, of course, has a few words to say about this too. This is just some things he says about speech that I thought were useful. So, right speech is what he says. Right speech also has implications for how we listen. The Buddha outlined a practice for staying mindful of how another person is addressing us without getting caught up in our own reactivity. And even more than that, he enjoined us to abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness. Bhikkhus, there are five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely. Oh, we've heard this. So it's the same list. Our mind will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So he's pointing to, it's not just how we speak. Those same things apply to how we listen. One of the greatest gifts you can give someone is to really listen to them. And often when we're listening to someone, at the same time we're listening, we're caught up in our busyness of telling some, figuring out how we're going to respond. No, they're wrong. I know the right answer. Blah, 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 blah. You know, it's so easy to get caught up in that. And he says, no, no, just let them speak and take it in and not be reactive to it. Don't feel like you need to be reactive to it. Just have a heart full of loving kindness. It's such a gift to give someone to really listen to them. So, with all your attention. I've experienced this with my teachers, a couple in particular, where I would speak with them. When I was speaking to them, it felt like they weren't paying attention to anything else. They just were paying attention to what I was saying. And it's just like, it just sets you so at ease when you're really listened to like that. Joseph goes on. Listening with compassion and loving kindness, even when harsh or untrue words are addressed to us, is a tremendously challenging aspect of mindfulness, and is a good example of what it means to be mindful externally as well as internally. Now, he's quoting from the refrain of the Satipatthana Sutta, where after each instruction, it says we should be both mindful externally and internally, and both. Although such listening may be very difficult to accomplish, in fact, many parents demonstrate it easily with young children. Children in moments of frustration or upset will yell at their parents, "I hate you." Having experienced that myself with my teenage daughter a long time ago. It's like, and yet for many parents, at least much of the time, the response remains loving. This practice would transform the world if people would begin to apply it throughout their lives. Just can we let what's happening, and it doesn't mean we have to sort of be lapdogs and let people run over us. There are times when we do need to speak, and we need to speak forcefully sometimes. But we have to do it not from a place of anger, not from a place of righteousness, but from a place of compassion and loving kindness. If we can do that, and then hopefully they'll feel that and they'll actually listen. As opposed to the barking part of what I often did, which people would never listen. When you bark, people would never listen. They would just get angry at you for being so barky. This is also, you see this list, as I said, this list is what is your speech timely, true, gentle, connected with good, and spoken with a mind of loving kindness. It's a good list, right? Timely, true, gentle, connected with good, and spoken with a mind of loving kindness. So if we can pause before we speak, it gives us a chance to see if this is true. And then we can just probably not speak as much. Then, after this, the Buddha goes on and he gives these really interesting images about speech. Suppose a man with a hoe and a basket and said, I shall make this earth to be without earth. He would dig here and there, strew the soil here and there, spit here and there, and urinate here and there, saying, be without earth, be without earth. What do you think, bhikkhus? Could that man make this great earth be without earth? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because this great earth is deep and immeasurable. It is not easy to make it without earth. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. Trying to dig away the earth. That's what often what we're doing when we're in our rant mode of speech. The next one. Bhikkhu, suppose a man came with crimson, turmeric, indigo, or carmine. These are traditional dyes used for cloth in India at the time, and today for that matter. I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space. So he's going to use these colored powders and draw pictures in empty space. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could this man draw pictures and make pictures appear in empty space? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because empty space is formless and non-manifestive. It is not easy to draw pictures there to make pictures appear. Eventually, the man would only reap weariness and disappointment. Bhikkhu, suppose a man came with a blazing grass torch and said, I shall heat up and burn away the river Ganges with this blazing grass torch. What do you think, Bhikkhu? Should the man heat up and burn away the river Ganges with this blazing grass torch? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because the river Ganges is deep and immense. It is not easy to heat it up and burn it away with a blazing grass torch. So he has these images that are all, if you think about it, right, there's like, two of them are quite violent. You know, the guy's going to hoe away the earth and he's going to burn away the earth. And the third one is the person's going to create this elusive image. This is often what we do with unwholesome speech. So these are sort of images of unwholesome speech putting it into interesting context. You know, we can't hoe away the earth, our speech, we can't make things, something go away. Something that's solid, it's not going to go away. We can't sort of drop, make things appear that aren't solid. And we can't melt things, we can't push things away with our fiery speech. It just doesn't work. So this is Sharon Salzberg, and she is speaking along these lines as well. And she's once again talking about anger. Nevertheless, the unskillful aspects of anger are immense, and they far outweigh the positive aspects. So she's not denying that sometimes anger is quite useful. If anger arouses us to action when action is needed, this sometimes is quite a useful thing. It's just that we have to get to that place where we see we have to do something and then not act from a place of anger, not act from sort of righteous energy. So we have to both accept that anger can be useful at times, but that then we have to sort of, okay, now I see I have to do something. Let's figure out how I can do this gently, with thoughts of loving kindness, with truthful, following the five, the list of five. The Buddha described it this way: anger, with its poisoned source and fevered climax, mirthlessly sweet, that you must slay to weep no more. It is sweet indeed, but the satisfaction we get from expressing anger is very short-lived, while the pain endures for a long time and debilitates us. It's true, like getting angry is like that whole venting energy. At the time you're caught in it, that sort of righteous feeling can be kind of sweet, but it doesn't last. And then we suffer the consequences of that rant. It's not doesn't it, I think it lasts a long time and it debilitates us. According to Buddhist psychology, the characteristic of anger is savageness. The function of anger is to burn up its own support, like a forest fire. It leaves us with nothing. It leaves us devastated. Just like a forest fire that ranges free and wild, anger can leave us in a place very far from where we intend to go. The deluding quality of anger is responsible for our losing ourselves in this way. When we are lost in anger, we do not see many options before us, and so we strike out recklessly. It's that thing about what the Dalai Lama said about trying to look at things from six different directions before you talk about it or act on it. Because often we're caught in this one-dimensional view, along the lines of they're right and I'm wrong. Action and aversion express themselves in acts of hostility and persecution. The mind becomes very narrow. It isolates someone or something, fixates on it, develops tunnel vision, sees no way out, fixes that experience, that person, or that object as being forever unchanging. Such aversion supports an endless cycle of harm and revenge. It's often we get fixated that that person is, or that situation, or those people, that company, that political party, they're bad, they're wrong. And we get really caught up in that. We see this reality politically. With racial struggle, with class struggle, with national struggle, with religious hatreds. Anger can bind people to each other as strongly as desire. I've seen that recently in this country. So that they drag each other along, connected through various kinds of revenge and counter-revenge. Never being able to let go, never being able to be still. The playwright and statesman Vaclav Havel has noted insightfully that hatred has much in common with desire, that it is the fixation on others, the dependence on them, and in fact the delegation of a piece of one's own identity to them. The hater longs for the object of his hatred. So it never ends, as long as people continue to relate in the same way. We are oppressed, we see an oppressed people being hurt and then often taking power and behaving in exactly the same way towards some other people. Someone sends us a letter accusing me and I accuse them back. How can I let go in such a situation? How can we change it? We can focus our attention more on the suffering of the situation, both our own and the suffering of others, rather than on our anger. We can ask ourselves whom we are really angry at. Mostly what we are angry at is the anger in the other person. I love that statement. Mostly what we are angry at is the anger in the other person. It is almost as if the other person were an instrument for the anger that moves through them and motivates them to an unskillful act. Do we become angry at somebody's mouth when they are shouting at us? We are angry at the anger that is motivating them to shout. If we add anger to anger, we only serve to increase it. In a well-known phrase, the Buddha said, "Hatred can never cease by hatred. Hatred can only cease by love. This is an eternal law. Happiness and unhappiness depends on our actions, how we act and react to what's going on in the world." Ah, this is great little piece in the Dhammapada that I really love. This is the Buddha in the Dhammapada speaking about anger. "This has come down, old Atula, and now, and not just from today. They find fault with one who sits silent. They find fault with one who speaks a great deal. They find fault with one who measures his words. There is no one unfaulted in the world. There never was, will be, nor at present is found, anyone entirely faulted or entirely praised. No matter what you do, people will find fault. No matter how you speak, someone will always find fault. So, don't react to their rant about what you said or how you said it. You know, just speak what needs to be speak and speak honestly. It's like, they find fault with one who sits silent. They find fault with one who speaks a great deal. They find fault with one who measures his words. There's no one unfaulted in the world." Then we get to the simile of the saw. It says, "Bhikkhu, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teachings. Here in Bhikkhus we should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we should utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for the welfare, with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, we shall abide pervading all the all-encompassing world with the mind imbued with loving kindness." So here he's saying, this is for bhikkhus, mind you. This is for renunciates, right? If someone came and started sawing them apart with a two-handed saw, they still, even then, need to have thoughts of loving kindness towards these people. This is an extreme example, right? But what he's pointing to is that we can't sort of set limits to our loving kindness. We can't set limits to our non-reactivity. We have to, as much as we can, not react. Now, if you were a bhikkhu, you had to let whatever happens happen. There are stories like this. There's actually a wonderful story that the Dalai Lama tells that is exactly along this line. There's the Dalai Lama escaped from Tibet in 1959, something like that. But many of the monks were captured and imprisoned and held in quite dire circumstances for a long time in Tibet when the Chinese communists took over. And so this one monk finally manages somehow to escape after like 20 years of being imprisoned. And he gets to the Dharamsala and he's talking to the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama says something like, how was it? And he said, Dalai Lama, and the monk says, oh, I was very afraid. And the Dalai Lama says, well, of course, you know, they were, you know, teaching, you know, torturing you and beating you and starving you. And the monk says, no, no, I was afraid I'd get angry. I was afraid I'd get angry. That's what he was worried about. That he would get angry, that he wouldn't have thoughts of loving kindness towards the people who had imprisoned him. This is an extreme, but it's also what happens, how people can come to that depth of loving kindness. It's just, I find it a wonderful example. Having said that, and I have a little note to myself here. Remember, this is all about a practice. Not about being perfect. You know, we don't really have to let people saw us apart with a two-handed saw, okay? We have to sort of understand where our edges are, where our limits are, and that we're growing into this. But we have, and but it's always this right speech and right action, you know, to the steps on the Eightfold Path. These are practices. They're not just sort of interesting philosophical concepts. They're not just ideas. There's something we consciously choose to practice. And then be mindful and try and actually act and speak from that place of loving kindness all the time. And that's the practice. That's the practice of actually putting the Buddha's teachings into action. Of course, I have a bit of poetry here. I'm sure some of you, I probably have heard me read this poem more than once, but I keep coming back to it because it's so lovely. It's called Awakening Now. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. Awakening Now. Why wait for your awakening? The moment your eyes are open, seize the day. Would you hold back when the beloved beckons? Would you deliver your litany of sins like a child's collection of seashells, prized and labeled? No, I can't step across the threshold, you say, eyes downcast. I'm not worthy. I'm afraid. And my motives aren't pure. I'm not perfect. And surely I haven't practiced nearly enough. My meditation isn't deep, and my prayers are sometimes insincere. I still chew my fingernails, and the refrigerator isn't clean. Do you value your reasons for staying small more than the light shining through the open door? Forgive yourself. Now is the only time you have to be whole. Now is the sole moment that exists to live in the light of your true self. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. Please, oh please, don't continue to believe in your disbelief. This is the day of your awakening.